I'd like to thank those who have come, especially those who have been with us these few days. And we've sort of done a little bit of acceleration from spirituality in the workplace, spirituality or spiritualizing relationships. And today we want to address somewhat of a deeper issue. We want to look at communications or spirituality, the spiritual aspect of higher communication. So since we are going to look at higher things, let me offer prayer first so that the things that I will say will go beyond just your mind as well as my intelligence or ego and will find its place within our hearts, connection with our souls. So I'll make a prayer. It's in Sanskrit, but it's asking for blessings from my spiritual master and his masters and masters, etc., giving ultimate honor to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Om Magana Timiranyasya Jana Jana Shilakshaya Shaksho Nilitam Yena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Sri Chaitanya Namo Vistam Sapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Siddhanti Sapratikam Vanchaka Patarubdasya Kripa Sindhu Devata Patitanam Papa Devyo Vaishnavevyo Namo Namaha. Thank you very much. I also offer a slight prayer to yourself, as we all have indwelling presence of God inside of us. We say that the Paramatma in Sanskrit, Sabasyaham, Sanivastoma, Takritya, Jnana, Poanamcha, that there is a presence of God that's providing knowledge, remembrance, intelligence, as well as forgetfulness for those who want to try to run away from the Lord in various ways. And a lot of the acceleration of communication is based on getting the blessings of God within and being able to connect with the spiritual realm. Not just the higher material realm, not just the metaphysical or psychic realm, but the transcendental realm. We have, of course, the physical body. We have a subtle astral body. We have so many subtle things that are in association with our subtle bodies, so many things we call miracles, or so many things that we consider to be paranormal, so many things that we consider to be extraordinary. But they are normal for the activities of the subtle body. But they're also things that are related to the soul. And so we want to look a little bit today about ways of being able to honor the soul and its ultimate connections and expressions with the kingdom of God and in association with the divine couple of Mother, Father, God. You have sheets before you. I hope we all, is anyone who needs one? Who doesn't have, raise your hand and we can try to get it to you. So I think we all have. So we're first looking and noticing that highest communications are really the connection with the Supreme Godhead. Or the highest communication is the language of the heart, is the message of the soul, or the union of the soul, the relationship of the soul. And sometimes we hear in mystical settings that soul above, soul below, soul above, emphasizing that there is some type of mystery of unfoldment that goes on above that has some parallel with below. But we know if we think about things below, we think about things that are limited, we think about fragmentations, we think about disturbances, we think about disappointments and a lot of anxiety, gloom, frustration. So normally we don't want to consider that things that are above may have any other patterns of the things that are below. But if we are starting from a platform of looking down, trying to look up, we will evaluate things based on our position of being down. If we're trying to see through our particular glasses from this particular platform of looking up, then there'll be a problem. But if we understand that the higher reality is coming from up, coming down, and so we cannot so easily evaluate things just based on the way that we normally in our orthodox scheme of perception try to see and try to understand. And so really, it's not that above is an environment where there is no activity, But above is the place where there is the divine, eternal, pure activity. And the fact that there is the below, where there is some activity, but is limited, we can understand, just as we discussed yesterday, if there is an artificial, if there is a counterfeit, it means that there is also a real. If there is some perversion, it means there is that which is also of a natural or normal status. So, when we first examine some conceptions about religious concerns, we look at four types of motivated worship. We've written the Sanskrit terminology. It's not necessary that you are so familiar with this. Sanskrit is one of the written languages of the world. Sanskrit is one of the languages spoken by many higher beings, extraterrestrials, sometimes apsaras, gandharas, kinnaras, etc. It is a language that goes beyond just kind of grunts and groans. More and more of the modern languages, you notice that they're having less and less kind of flowery conceptions, but they're dealing more with how to maintain growth, eating, sleeping, mating, and defending. So some of the more ancient languages, that they have a way of invoking higher consciousness, they have a way of addressing more profound conceptions. And so often you'll find in religious orders, and especially in mystery schools, you'll find that people will often chant mantras or prayers in the original languages. So we just have the Sanskrit word there for you, but of course we have the particular meaning. First way that there is motivation in worship. See, as long as there is motivation, as long as people are doing things on a conditional basis, there can never be the purest expression of love. Because love is never just based on business, it's never just based on utilitarianism, it's never just based on being loving because of or if. But it is being loving consistently because one is in fact loving, because one is imbibing more and more or accelerating more of their higher consciousness. So when we look at motivated platforms of worship, we realize that these platforms cannot have pure connection of love. First is bhaya. Many people, they engage in particular worship out of fear, meaning that they're afraid that if they do not do certain things, that they will be condemned, that they will go to hell, that they will suffer in various ways. So they are mostly following some religious dharma because they are considering what things may happen to them if they don't. It is out of fear more than out of knowledge, more than out of something higher. Some years ago, I was asked by the president of Ghana in one of the African countries, well, not by the president himself, but by his minister of defense and minister of treasure and foreign secretary, if I would consider acting as a consultant for the country. And at some point we were sending various books and literatures and things to the president. And we were kind of wondering from time to time, is he really reading these books? Is he taking advantage of any of the communications that we were making available to him? So at one point there was some problems in the country, some religious conflict. And so the president summoned many of the religious leaders of the country. And he made a very powerful statement that we understood was directly from the connections that we were having with him. But it was very disturbing to the theologians and very disturbing to much of the press. In his statement, when he gathered these religious personalities together, he said, part of the problem is that you are all fearing God and you are not loving God. Now, for some people, this is practically blasphemous because they were considering that the president does not fear God. And this was the headline. The president does not fear God. So he was trying to offer them something higher. He was trying to let them know that if we are just trying to serve the divine Godhead based on fear, this is not really so profound. Just like if the child is doing certain things out of fear, then the child will act in the proper way as long as that threat of fear is there. And when the fear is not there, or when the players who repose that fear are not observant, then one will do deviant things. But when the child is acting based on understanding and based on love, then the person does not have to be there who is overseeing or arranging for the laws or for the rules, etc. But the child will do the necessary because of understanding and because of love. So he was helping them to really appreciate that you are so much working out of fear, and this is creating a kind of sectarianism, because you are doing things according to what you feel will be best for your group, your organization, or you're trying to do things mainly based on avoidance. Next is called asya. This is worship that is conditional, is motivated, but it's for satisfying material aspirations. Many times, people only think anything about the Godhead when they want things, various items, when they want certain experiences. So what they're really doing is, instead of trying to enter into a relationship of love, exchange, and service, they are mainly trying to summon or invoke the presence of God to be their servant. Often, people, as they engage in their mantras, their prayers, as they engage in their particular activities, their rituals, etc., their salat, that in their mind, they're just in a mood of, "Dear Lord, give me better health, better job, I need a new car, I need to have a raise, I need to become the supervisor or remove my supervisor, help my uncle, niece, nephew, brother, cousin, and grandparents, etc." And so, even though this sounds quite strange, but this is how most people, in fact, are involved in their spirituality. And they think, well, why not? What is God for other than to be like a servant? Or other than to be there when we need the presence, when we need certain things, or when we need to have some obstacles removed from our normal connections with sense gratification. So sometimes people are not so much interested in love, in service, in realization, but they're just frustrated that things are not going so good for them based on how they are normally functioning. So they are feeling, well, let me try this metaphysical, this psychic, let me try this spiritual thing and see if it will bring about some type of fulfillment. Let me see if it will be able to eradicate some of the obstacles. So the starting platform is not really about trying to become or to experience divine love, but it's mostly about just how to function in such a way that one can suffer peacefully. And so this is not a very high expression. It is motivated and conditional. Most people, what they call happiness, is just simply a temporary upliftment of the ongoing suffering, depression, and boredom. But obviously, that is not real happiness, just the opposite of something. But real happiness, love, and knowledge is a thing of its own. Next we see Kartavya Buddhi, out of some duty. Still somewhat mixed, or it is still based on motivation. It is not sublime and pure, but it is due to certain rules that one is trying to honor, and also certain rules that one is trying to be careful to avoid. It is things that are to be done that are prescribed to be proper, and certain things to be avoided that are considered offenses, that are considered to be weeds that will disturb the creeper of growth of devotion. So this platform one should definitely maintain on until they're on a more spontaneous level. Rituals, rules, religions, these things are necessary to ultimately to bring about more of an internal connection. If we deny such a foundation, we'll not be able to make an organic connection to that which goes beyond such. Now, of course, fear that sometimes people make the ritual the all in all. Just like one of the difficulties of religious institutions is sometimes the institution begins to take over the religion or the theology or the philosophy. meaning that people are more concerned with the form and the mechanical activities or the politics or the externals, and they move farther and farther away from accessing the interior, from accessing the essence. And we see that happening decade after decade. So these are four things that are there which interfere with our higher communication. These are things which cause us to literally defeat ourselves. These are things that are based on certain motivations as we pursue the spiritual path. Then our fourth category is called raga, out of genuine attraction, meaning that it is not something that is done just out of fear. And so one does the right thing because they're afraid of what chastisement or what disturbances, what punishment or whatever may be there. It's not something that is just to satisfy material inklings, things that people are attracted to. It's not something where we are demanding and ordering the Godhead to arrange on our behalf, nor is it just out of duty. We can do the right thing because out of duty, but that, of course, is not love. When people are relating in a way of mutual love, then one does not just do things for their beloved just because out of duty. But it's especially when one is going out of their way or they're doing something because they know it is for the well-being of their beloved, because they know that it is a way of honoring their beloved's presence, etc. So when the knowledge and love is deep and the connections are deep and have transcended the gross and the subtle levels of alignment, then it is spontaneous and is exhilarating, because that is the nature of the soul. It is, we say in Sanskrit, Satchidananda Vigraha, it is full of knowledge. It is full of bliss. And it is eternal. And so self-realization really is not about learning so much new things, but it's about what we are uncovering, how to be free of superfluous involvements that have come into our lives. It is about how to remove the acculturation that has brought in more and more of the devastation of material energy. Then we go to our second category, are the five types of differences between religions. Now, this first type, Acharya Bheda, is that there's a difference in teachers. So we honor the fact that there is ultimately one God, one Mother, Father, God. There's one supreme personality of Godhead. There is one ultimate, whether we call God Allah, Yahweh, Jehovah, Krishna, Mother, Father, God, Divine, etc., is ultimately referring to the same supreme personality of Godhead. However, we can appreciate that that same supreme personality is sending different representatives according to desha kalapatra, time, place, and circumstance. So sometimes these ambassadors have very, very specific duties. Sometimes they are of different quality in terms of what they have to give to the people. And sometimes they are having the same thing, but they're being asked to present certain things based on what is needed at a particular time. Just like 20 of us may go to the same university, take the very same degree, but our service, our duty, our work may be different. Someone remains and working at the university, someone is in high school, someone is working in the city government. Sometimes they're representatives that are of a similar spiritual empowerment and endowment, but have different tasks. Sometimes representatives are different in capacity themselves. When we look at many of the major proponents of the different religious traditions, we'll find that on most part they are quite similar in what they know and where they have come from, but different in what they have given to the planet. And we'll try to, well, let's give some ideas. How Jesus made very emphatic, he says, there are many things which I could tell you, but you're not ready for it yet. Muhammad, when he made his ascension, he was given three calibers of knowledge. This was one of the highest connections that Muhammad was having with Allah. He said he was given three connections of knowledge. He was given knowledge that he was to keep only for himself. He was given knowledge that he was to tell the people. And third, he was given knowledge that he was to decide himself whether to share it or whether or not, based on circumstance. These particular messengers, even though they were quite similar to certain other very evolved messengers, but they had particular assignments to render. When we look at any bona fide messengers coming from connection with the spiritual realm, we find that there's always these similarities. They're emphasizing love God with all your heart, love your neighbor yourself, and this world is not yours. And then they have various ways how they try to remind people this is not their home, how they try to guide people out of incarceration, of being captured by the lower modes of nature, and how they try to stimulate people to be loving amongst themselves and ultimately to render love toward God. Our next one is number 2. And for speed, we'll just read in English. Difference in the worshiper's mentality and consequent expression of reverence. Just as different systems have different days that they worship as holy. Sometime back in Europe, I was doing a television program, and also in Africa, with religious leaders of different traditions. And once around Christmas time, we were being asked, what is our holy day? And so someone said, with given reasons, why Friday is the best day to worship. Someone else was referring to Saturday. Someone, Sunday. And someone was suggesting that there's no need to worship at all, etc. And so I was called upon, and I just said simply, is there any day that is not God's day? Isn't it that every day is an opportunity to try to glorify the Lord? Is it that we take only Friday as God's day and the rest of the week belongs to who? Or is it that Saturday is only God's day and if so, the rest of the week belongs to who? Or if it's only Sunday, etc. But again, many people, this is how they involve themselves in their religious system, is that they do whatever they feel inspired to do based on what is functional and relative for the immediate gratification of the senses. And then one day of the week, or maybe one day of the month, or maybe at some special time that they find themselves more deeply or involved in something spiritual, when other times they're not. But when there is, again, love, it's not something you turn on and you turn off. It is that one is constantly trying to honor and to connect with the object of their particular love. So different systems will honor different days, will have different expressions in such ways. Or we find that there are different ways how some of the systems are approaching reincarnation. We see that the Bible mentions how we reap what we sow. And as we look deeper and deeper in some of the esoteric aspects of the Bible, we'll find many, many expressions letting us understand that there's something beyond the physical body. In Corinthians, it says that we have a terrestrial body and we have a celestial. Celestial being the physical and celestial being the spiritual. And in 2 Corinthians, it says, while we are in the terrestrial or the physical, we are away from God. And of course, it emphasizes that flesh and blood does not go to the kingdom of God. In the Quran, it says, in Quran 2:28, it says, how can you deny Allah? Did he not give you life when you were dead? And will he not cause you to die and then restore you to life? Will you not return to him at last? Emphasizing that there is this cycle of samsara, or there is the activity that one has been given life, and life goes on, and then there is termination, and then there's ultimate chance for life to reside in association, or the soul to reside in association in the spiritual kingdom. See, there are two ways of looking at most theology. You can look at religion from an exoteric aspect as well as an esoteric. The exoteric, we find those practitioners are more concerned with just the external and the ritual, etc. And the esoteric practitioners, they're those who genuinely go deep in bona fide systems and bona fide practices. And so they sort of go beyond just the form. They realize that they may use certain rituals, they may use certain terminologies, they may use certain even texts, but ultimately it is about experiencing of higher consciousness. They realize it is about having the experience and making the contact. that it never has been just about a particular system per se, but it is about the element of conscious raising in connection with experiencing the divine love. So religions in one sense are like vehicles. The people are eager to ride different types of vehicles according to their natures, etc. But the significant thing is not so much your vehicle, but is it carrying you where you need to go? And it is unfortunate when people want to knock others because they want to push them off the road, or they're so insecure they cannot see or appreciate someone else who is riding a different type of vehicle. Now, of course, some vehicles are just clunkers. They're going to be trouble. And some vehicles look very good, and they still have some trouble because of the condition that it's in. But if we are having a good vehicle and we're moving accordingly, then, of course, all the bona fide religious systems emphasize that such is to be honored. Sectarianism is something that has evolved due to humankind's or expression of becoming less and less fixed in the experience of God consciousness. And so therefore, when there is such lack or when there is such superficial connection, then there is more fragmentation, there is more stagnation, and there is more manipulation and exploitation. Number three, differences in the method of worship. Just like in some cases, people worshiping in a temple, in a mosque, in a cathedral, worshiping in a bush, worshiping in their shrine, etc. And so obviously these are just external things that make up some differences, but for people who are not so grounded, these differences create confusion. As we see sometimes, some of the worst inhumanities to humankind are under the banner of people involving themselves in some type of religious doctrine that is of a fanatical basis, or people hide behind religion while they involve themselves in all kinds of other things. Then we have number four, differences in the conceptions and conventional actions concerning the objects of worship. This one is a little delicate sometimes for those who are in the mindset that there is only one prophet or there is only one son of God. And so, of course, this is quite elementary in general. And I'm sure very few of you will have this kind of thinking. But since most of these programs are aired on TV and other places, we'll just address that a little bit. So the idea of son of God, when we look first at Christianity, we find that this is not even what the Bible says. Because we find, for instance, in John 1:12, it says, as many as followed him, to them he gave the power to become sons of God. David speaks in Psalms, he says, today I am being honored and blessed as a begotten son. Sometimes they emphasize there's only one son, and there's only one begotten son, etc. We can appreciate that this position of son is a position. It is a certain ambassadorship. And that when there are these entities who are representing the spiritual kingdom, then they are pure sons or pure daughters of the Godhead. To think that the messenger only comes once and only in one particular way is actually somewhat cruel. Because often we find in the process of education, in the process of guiding people, we give a message in one particular way, and then in the compassionate mood, we find a way how to get the same message across, but sometimes to explain it in different terminology or to give other types of assistance. And then there is the conception that sometimes that the representatives are in fact the all in all themselves. But proper representatives, they, yes, it's like an ambassador is not just only a man or a woman, but they are having the power of attorney representing the particular country. And so they are similar. They are one, and as much as they are in harmony with representing things in the proper way, but at the same time, they are different. Number five, difference in God's name and teachings due to linguistic differences. Every great theology comes along with scripture, comes along with saints that help to support it. It comes along with original acharyas or sons of God that are very instrumental in keeping these things together. And we find that according to the messenger, because the messengers have personalities, they come in a certain body, they come in a certain part of the world, and they speak a certain language. And they may use different names of how they address the Godhead. Just like in our Vedic tradition here, we address God as Krishna. Or we understand that there is a masculine and there is a feminine aspect of the presence of the Godhead. And we see that in Christianity, there's an emphasis that in Romans it says, whoever calls the name of the Lord shall be saved. On some, we call on God from the rising of the sun to the setting. In the Quran, 17:210, it says that the most beautiful names belong to the Lord, so call upon him by them. 780, it says, from the rising, it says that whatever names that one calls on God, if these names are beautiful. In the Mormon teachings, book 282, it emphasizes something similar to the Bible. In the morning, in the afternoon, in the evening, to call upon God's name. In the teachings of Buddhism, of Dhammita, Buddha, about 18, Buddha emphasizes, whoever calls on the divine name shall attain paradise. We find in the mystery schools like Ekankar, in the book You Need to Know, emphasizes that calling on the names of God will remove the barriers that interfere with one's perception of the divine, divine light, divine sound, and divine realizations. From one system to the next, in the Bhagavad Gita, in the 10th chapter, Krishna is mentioning that of sacrifices, he is the calling of the name, of, calling on the holy name. So, we go from one system to the next. There is an emphasis about the power of mantra, an emphasis of how sound affects individual consciousness and how it affects the collective environment. It is often people who minimize the importance of these universalities as they bring in various types of fragmentation. And then we move down to three types of irreligion. One is called Vidharma, religious principles that obstruct one from following his own religion. So sometimes, as one is trying to follow a bona fide system, the person may involve themselves or be imposed upon in ways that obstruct their ability to be able to follow such. What is important is that if anyone goes deep in any bona fide spiritual practices, they will begin to come in touch with certain universals. There are people who have come from different paths, different connections, and as they have attained those certain levels of consciousness, they share such a wonderful connection and a wonderful fraternalhood because they're experiencing similar things. It's not that spirituality is just yata mata tata pata. It's just something that just happens. It is the highest science. It is far above and far transcending normal science. And there are certain things, when done properly, produce certain types of results. There are certain levels of awareness that one acquires based on reaching a certain intensity. And we will talk about that in a few minutes. And when there is this sectarianism, it attacks not only other systems, but it attacks one's own system. In the Quran, it's emphasized, and abuse not those whom they call upon besides Allah. Meaning that people, those of the Quran, may use or relate to calling on the Lord is Allah. But the Quran says, do not abuse those. Abuse not those when they call upon beside Allah, best exceeding the limit. They abuse Allah through ignorance. This to every people have we made their deeds fair. That just thinking that we can only access divinity through one particular name, whether it's the Torah, the Quran, the Bible, the Vedas, etc., people who are thinking that way are being dishonest to their own theology and are literally causing sabotaging within the spiritual paradigm. The founder, Srila Prabhupada, of the ISKCON Society, he says, not that superficially I am once reconstructing a temple in India, in Vrindavan, and he was giving a speech in 1974, he was saying, not that superficially I am very advanced in religion, but I do not know how to love. This is the test. Sava sakino bhavantu. This is a test. A devotee wants to see that everyone is happy. It doesn't matter whether it is a Hindu, a Muslim, a Christian, etc. It doesn't matter. We want to see that everyone is happy, meaning that everyone is happily involved in following their prescribed theology, and that they're getting the results, or they are following the spiritual technology, and they are experiencing deeper and deeper levels of consciousness. And then there is the Paradharma, religious principles introduced by others, meaning some contamination, adulteration, things that have come in by whim that has weakened the potency. And then Chala Dharma, cheating religion, where people are not really practicing religion, but are involved in business and politics and just calling it religion. Now, there are different conceptions that people have of God, which sometimes has to do with what their ultimate experiences are. First, we find that some people's idea of the God connection is being free from variegatedness. Some people's idea of the ultimate state of God consciousness is experiencing a sort of a nirvana, where there is freedom from desire, and there is freedom from relationship, heterogeneity, etc. And so other people have their conception of God as an expression of universal intelligence, universal mind, or ultimate universal sound, or ultimate divine light. They are connected with systems and practices that ultimately allow them to experience a cosmic consciousness, a samadhi, etc., where they're experiencing a oneness with all that is, or where they're feeling that they are all that is, etc. And they're following various practices that will connect them with this level of experience. And then there are those who have the understanding or feeling that the ultimate connection with the Godhead is being able to honor morality, ethics, or beauty. And they see that their God is the beauty that is found in so many different situations. And they address God in that particular way, coming out in such a way. And the others who experience or are interested in pursuing spiritual technology that will connect them with being able to experience God in just objects, not just conceptions or feelings, but in objects, in the trees, the moon, in the sun, animals, etc. And then there are those who are involving themselves in trying to connect with the Godhead in being able to experience spiritual personality, variegatedness, etc. Not material personality or material variegatedness, but, as we mentioned in the metaphysical school, so above, so below, emphasizing that, yes, there is material relationship, there is material sambandha or association, and these material things are temporary, but there are spiritual associations, variegated activities, that are not limited, and that are the real, and that the spiritual things are really what is manifesting or creating the material things. Material objects and material activities are a reflection of something that is permanent, that is eternal. It's like you look at yourself in the mirror, we said last night, or if you are looking in the water and you see a reflection. Reflection is there because there is something that it is reflecting from. One of the things we want to kind of end some of this discussion with and bring it into our theme today is that when we look at these mystery schools, psychic phenomena, we look at various theologies, and we look at them in terms of the rituals and the exterior, we'll find so many things that seemingly do not connect. So many things that even take on more of an impersonal aspect. But the more that we look at something scrutinizingly, more we begin to observe its specific attributes. In one sense, there is no such thing as impersonal energy, because whether it is sound, light, water, whether it is just an atom, a neutron, a light wave, such items, such commodities are having specific qualities, and also specific relationships, and also specific forms. We take a drop of water, we take air, anything. We look at it very deeply, we'll find that it is comprised of small parts that are variegated and that they attract, compel, unite, produce, etc. So in one sense, it is like an oxymoron. We think that there is something that does not interact or have relationship. If something is existing, it is interacting or relating to other things. If it is in heaven, some type of existence, then it means it has some dharma, it has some essence. Otherwise, it doesn't exist. You can try to reflect on whatever and conceive of something that is a reality or is existing, but it has no dharma, has no function, has no essence, has no relationship to other phenomena. As such, it doesn't exist. So the idea of being void of relationship, or the idea of ultimately impersonalism, is just some conceptual consideration that really doesn't actually mean anything. Everything is always somehow in some kind of relationship. So what we find as we go deeper and deeper into more the interior of the mystery schools, the interior into the Orthodox religion, we will constantly find more and more connection of a personal level. If I do not know you well, I treat you impersonally. If I do not study something very deeply, then I have some general understanding of its relationship, its essence, etc. But the more I hone in, I realize a beautiful building, and I think closer, something about the architect, what was his idea or her idea. I see a painting, I see a creation. I see various movements in motion. I can look at what has happened, what is manifested, or I can look at what is really behind it, and we'll always bring everything back to a personal level. Not only are the most minute things personal, but even the most grand things are personal. The earth is one personal living entity. The moon is one living entity. The sun is one living entity. The galaxy is one living entity. Just as our own physical body is like a universe within itself. And the dominant consciousness is what we call our identity. But even within one person's body, there are hundreds of thousands of life forms. Cells, germs, all kinds of living presence that's there. And it's relative according to size and according to duration of life. For the ant to go from this wall to the next wall, it's a long distance because of the size of its body. But for someone has human body to go from one wall to the next, it's only a matter of a few steps. So size and duration, longevity, all of these things are relative. For the little germ that's in our body, this universe is undefinable. For Mother Bhumi, for Mother Earth, we are doing so many harmful things by rupturing the womb of Mother Bhumi, by nuclear tests, by toxic waste, by all kinds of electromagnetic effects in the atmosphere, and even by just lying propaganda or improper thoughts. We're constantly causing a endangered and sick planet. So no wonder there's an increase in earthquakes, hurricanes, tornadoes, famines, because any system, when we abuse it, any body, when we abuse it, it begins to malfunction or becomes diseased. And our systems have a natural way of trying to fight off intrusions, germs, attacks. And so what we are experiencing more and more, especially in the last 20, 30 years, and even in the last decade, that Mother Earth is becoming so sick. And we see the reaction of just so many people who are dying due to part of the cleansing. Just a year and a half ago, we'd say, well, about 2 years ago, in that 1 year of 55,000 people died just that year, and 300 million people were displaced just by earth changes alone. So many people are being displaced, so many people are dying, but it's happening in pockets here, there. And as long as we keep abusing such living organisms, then we'll get various types of results. And now we find people getting heart disease and cancer and so many things because of how we are abusing our physical and subtle presence, our bodies. And so we're getting various types of reactions. And the atmosphere is becoming so bombarding, so many unhealthy things that what's happening, our immune systems are getting weaker. So there's a need for people to be much more careful about how you take care of your body, because as you're taking care of what you consider to be you, you're also addressing hundreds of thousands of other life forms that are connected with the karma that your dominant soul is connected with. So as we look at, again, tuning into personalism, we find, well, let's look at Islam first. Once Muhammad was coming late to prayer, and he was apologizing, and he said that, I am sorry that I'm late, but I have been in association with Allah, and we were talking as friends, and I rested my hand on his shoulder. There is a Quran, there's a hadith, there's a Muslimawata. Sometimes there's a religious theology, there's a theology talking about the biography of the great saints, and there are commentaries on such. You find this in most religious systems. So in the hadith, it talks about that the highest experience in paradise is to behold the vision of Allah. That the highest experience in paradise, the greatest knowledge brings on the greatest relationships, it brings on the greatest association, which brings on the greatest exchanges of love. In this ascension I was referring to, and I spoke this many times to imams in our study, we are interested in all theology that is about love, and particularly going beyond just the external, because there's so many universals that are there. And many of the things are sometimes confusing, because sometimes some of the higher knowledge, due to a political infringement and disturbance, sometimes had to be go underground surreptitiously, and in the process of that, many things get lost, or there are times when ecumenical councils meet, and they make all kinds of changes and distort phenomena that could be more beneficial for the individual, so that they can control the masses a lot more. But this is an interesting time on the planet where basically whatever knowledge and whatever people have comes out. If there is some empowerment that comes out, if there's some deviation, these are very interesting times. There is amazing influence that is also being propagated by higher beings to try to help make some adjustments on the planet at this very critical time in human history. In this ascension that Muhammad was making, he went to the lower planet, and then to the medium, and then to the higher. And he was being escorted by Angel Gabriel, who was instrumental in helping to offer the world the Quran. And it explains in Islamic theology that he arrives at what is called heaven. And at that point, Angel Gabriel was not able to go any farther. And then it describes in Arabic, he went to what is called Sudrat Hill, that he went somewhere beyond heaven, where at that point he met Allah face to face. And then it begins to describe that at that point he had a relationship with Allah like friends. Or even the Bible. The Bible says, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Meaning that the earth as well as the heavens are a creation. Where was God before he created these things? There was some environment that was eternal that is more related to the Godhead than what he created at some particular point. So there are, again, if we go deep into these theologies and have keys to open up, we find that they are very similar but have been sometimes mistaught, watered down by people who are pursuing economic considerations, political, rather than love, devotion, and in fact, service, unconditional, unmotivated service. In the Torah, it mentions that the Lord spoke to Moses face to face as a man speaks to a friend. Now someone says, oh, this is just allegorical. This is just conceptual. And many people, this is how they address some of these deeper things that they're not able to understand. Just like when you read the Psalms, when you read the Song of Solomon in the Bible, the entire book is a love exchange between humankind and God. But most times people read that, they think it is just something poetic because they do not understand that there can be such a deep level of connection, such a level of purity with the soul, where they are very, very powerful personal relationship that can be experienced. Or they're thinking when there is the idea of a God that it means something or someone that's limited, because when they normally reflect on personality. They think only of material personality, starting from here, trying to look up, trying to evaluate the higher based on the patterns of the lower. In the Torah, it also mentions that Sarah had a relationship to the Lord like a mother. In the Torah, it also mentions Enoch and Abraham, that God would appear to them, and they had ongoing wonderful exchanges. In the Bible, we find, in Christianity, we find that sometimes the great mystics like St. Teresa of Avila, St. John of the Cross, that they did not just talk about hearing the light, experiencing the sound, but that they had certain personal experiences with the spiritual kingdom, with the spiritual dimension, and with the Godhead. In the Christian Judaic teachings, it emphasizes that the pure in heart, in the New Testament, shall see God. In St. John it says, not that any man can know the Father, but he who is of God can. Emphasizing that there is a certain level of consciousness where one has full right to be able to do the natural. It is unnatural to not be able to have direct communication with one's beloved. It is unnatural not to be able to be in association with one's mother or father. It is unnatural not to be able to have association with one's authority. It is impersonal. It is a lack of accelerating the highest expression of that exchange. It is natural to be able to be in touch. It is natural to have reciprocation. And so there is also mentioned in the Christian teachings in the book of Revelation that in the very last chapter, in one or two of the last verses, it says how there will be many plagues, many difficulties, many famines, so many things. It says, but there shall be people who shall be known as the sons or the children of God. They shall wear the mark of the Lord on their forehead, and they shall see his face. Not he will hear the sound, not that you will see the light, not that you will feel oneness and lose identity, but that you will gain everything, feel everything, while still maintaining identity. The idea that ultimately everything is to become less void of identity when so above, so below. If there is identity, if there's relationship, if there's variegatedness in the lower realm, it is just that that is a perverted, imperfect state, and that the higher states are always that of specific relationship, defined connections, and ultimately love. How do we love a concept? We can have general feelings, but you love based on specific knowledge exchanges. You love based on awareness. You love based on service. These are specific attributes of exchange. This is relationship, knowledge, etc. You like something, you dislike, but when you have great affection and love, or you have very great distaste, there are specific things that are causing the love and specific things that are causing the distaste. Otherwise, this is just a general feeling. So the more that one is able to acquire certain esoteric spiritual transcendental knowledge and act upon that, the more one can be in experience in connection with the beloved. Just as when you love someone, you want to know what they want. You want to know how to be there for them. So you understand that they like a certain type of soup. And so if you decide you want to make a French fries and only like soup, that's not a sign that you're really trying to serve and be there for them. The more that you know what they want, what some things about their personality, their secret tendencies, then to that degree, there is so much more union, togetherness. There's so much appreciation because things are going in such a mood of harmony and appreciation. So as we are able to know more about who we are, know more about who others are, know more about the spiritual kingdom, then we can be more natural with those things and experience who we, what we can experience by the taking away the cover that is causing the obfuscation. We also have the example in some of the mystery teachings. We have many mystery schools, the Grail movement, the Ekankar movement, the Theosophy movement. In the Ekankar, they have this book called The Flute of God. Once I was doing a panel discussion, and I asked one of the leaders, what is the coming of theology? What is the highest expression that one can experience? What is the ultimate? Because when we pursue trying to know some system, there are three things we should immediately ask ourselves. We should want to know, what is the ultimate goal? If I become perfect in that system, what can I ultimately expect to achieve? Many times people are involving themselves in things, in some system, and they don't have the clue of what the ultimate goal of that is. And there are times when we find out what the ultimate goal is, and we realize, no, I'm not comfortable with that. We all have free will. But the idea is expressing our free will, but being somewhat clear on what we are connecting with. So sometimes an ultimate system is that if you follow this, the ultimate accomplishment, the ultimate achievement is that you will be able to kill all of your enemies. Some people are happy with that, so they should pursue it. Sometimes the ultimate conclusion of this, the ultimate experience of such, is that you will be able to capture anyone and make them your lover. And so they may want to involve themselves in certain things and such. Or the ultimate is that you experience the nirvana, or the samadhi, or the cosmic consciousness, etc. When we find out what the ultimate thing is, that's first question. Second should be, what am I to do to acquire that ultimate? If we are comfortable with that, then we should go to the third. If we're not comfortable, keep shopping until we are wanting to align with what are the things to do, because every system has various tenets what a person is supposed to do to acquire that particular goal. And if someone is introducing you to something and say you have to do nothing, then you run away, because there's no bona fide system that will give you higher realization where one does wait for it to happen. Everything in the universe is reciprocating. And so even where someone seems to not have done very much in this lifetime because of some due they paid in another lifetime, along, of course, with mercy. Mercy is there. There's so many entities that are helping, just as there are those in the physical presence. There are so many yogis and rishis and teachers and, as we said, gandharas and apsaras, who never enter into the physical form, or we will never see them until we have higher vision. Like the time before Lord Buddha was on the planet, there was so much more transitions going on, higher beings coming into this particular realm and interacting. But after Lord Buddha's time, the environment became more and more gross, more and more sinful. So many higher beings did not feel so comfortable in coming into an environment that was so geared for destruction and devastation, and where people were so much about trying to just intrude on each other and engage in all types of sectarianism, etc. But when someone is of higher consciousness, then when some of these beings do enter, there's no problem for them to be in tune, to see and to experience and to interact, and even to call forth such entities. In very powerful rituals and yajnas, it is never about only the persons that are physically present. It is about trying to assist those who are present, bringing in also helpers, and also honoring those who may have come due to the fact of the potency of the particular ritual or yajna. This is sometimes we have these prayers after a ceremony is over, and the Sanskrit is there, but in the prayer we say, all glories to the assembly of saints or assembly of devotees. We're saying all glories to those who we see who are in attendance, all glories to those who hopefully have come due to the fact that this yajna, this ceremony, these hymns, these prayers were such a potency that it brought higher beings who do not necessarily manifest so much physically unless one has the sight to see. And so we say all glories to such persons, understanding that, again, it is about personality, it's about relationship. It is about, just as the Bible says, one is a terrestrial body and a celestial, a physical body or physical form, as well as a spiritual form. We consider form as just material, but that is because we're looking from below, looking up. The last two things we'd like to share is that this idea of flute of God. So I was inquiring from one of the ex-masters at this time on the planet. And I said, it's interesting you have a book, one of your major books called The Flute of God. Can you explain something to me about the sound that ultimately one hears when they have the highest connection with the Godhead? As I said, when you want to hear a teaching, you find out what is the ultimate goal, what are the things to do to acquire that, and then last you want to know where and how can you find and view and understand and perceive and talk to or evaluate some of those who have done that and have acquired the goal. We ask, what is the goal? You see, are we comfortable with what is the thing? We are interested in that. We go for the second thing. Second thing is, what is to be done? We find out some system says, oh, you can acquire this, but you have to take your firstborn and you sacrifice her or sacrifice him. Or you have to get this body part and do this, do that. Or you must do so much meditation, 12 hours a day. You say, well, I want the goal, but I don't feel I can do what it takes. I go somewhere else, do something else. But if we are comfortable with what is to be done, we like the goal, then we want to know about some entities who have done that and have acquired that, and we want to check them out. We want to find if how they live and what they're experiencing is what we are comfortable that we want to experience. And when such is there, then one should use his or her free will and pursue that. So I was just sort of interested in this particular metaphysical system that if the highest sound in that expression is the flute of God, and I was just inquiring, can you tell me a little bit more about the flute? Can you tell me a little bit more about the flute player? And there was a silence. Because that is where the knowledge stops. But as we understand, there's a flute, there's a player, there's a sound, I make a sound. Somewhere, somebody has put that sound, something is into motion. But if it is a spiritual sound, it's not put into motion by necessarily a material being or a material force. But the motion is there. The delegating is there. So we find in the Vedic systems there is emphasis that there are various personal expressions of the Godhead, incarnations, planetary expansions, etc. Or some of you notice when you come here to this particular center, there is the form of the deity or the Archivigraha or the Murti, and the Murti is playing a flute. And you also find, just a couple of weeks ago, I was in an interfaith conference with some members from the Vatican and from some other groups, and I was asking them about this phenomena of the self-manifested deity. And I asked one of the representatives from the Vatican, what is the conception of the self-manifested deity? Is that just a conception? Is this an idea? Is it a reality? Does the Vatican recognize that such a thing happens? Is it real? Is it accepted? And of course, he says, yes, it's accepted. And my question was, is the self-manifested presentation, is it more potent than the statues that we create? Does it have a special significance? And how does this form manifest out of nothing? And what about some of the Madonnas that cry sometimes? And what about some of the statues that communicate to people in other ways? And so I was just trying to draw a point that there are certain things that are similar, that are constantly appearing in all the various realities. As we go deeper and deeper, we touch upon very personal experiences. We touch upon very what we call miracles. They're miracles because they are things that we are not ordinarily, normally understanding or part of our day-to-day experience. But these things that we normally call miracles or psychic phenomena are mostly things that are dealing with a subtle expression of ourselves and of reality. And various times when we are not blocking, then more of the natural is in fact taking place. I'll end with this. In a Vedic theology, obviously I have some connection with that, as well as I've been a Christian evangelist, I've been a Buddhist, Muslim, and all in this lifetime, and many more things in so many other lifetimes. At the same time, we're none of those, because the soul is none of that. Like I'm now in an African-American body in this lifetime, that is just a costume that we're wearing. It's like the suit that I have on. None of us are these costumes. The other day at the psychic fair, I started some of my presentation by talking a little bit about psychic phenomena. One of the things I mentioned is that everyone in this room is an extraterrestrial. Everybody on this planet is an extraterrestrial. There is no permanent entity, permanent being who permanently resides in this particular universe. This whole universe, this whole planet is a transit place. It's just a matter of how recent one has come. But the soul does not stay in these kinds of environments. And so it's just a matter of how recent that someone may have come in, or maybe somebody has walked out, it's a terrestrial walkout or whatever. But these things are really only seemingly extraordinary because people are looking at it from below looking up, or they're looking at it based on the normative, orthodox cosmologies and epistemologies and it becomes super extraordinary. But spirituality has always been something full of adventure and excitement. Last thing we'd like to share with you, the Vedic system, especially the Puranas, emphasize that one can evaluate the Godhead somewhat similar to like a judge. For instance, a judge can be interacted with in different levels. Normally we think of the judge as the person who has great authority, great influence over life and death even for some people. And so there's a certain etiquette in dealing with the judge, etc. So this is considered the way people normally may think of God, at least those who are theistic, want to accept that there is some God presence. They think of the Godhead mainly as the supreme autocrat, or the powerful Aishvara, who is overseeing and dictating and demanding, etc. And that is, of course, an aspect of the judge's responsibility. Now, the lawyer has a different relationship with the judge. Also honors the judge in a superior position, but he is also a member of the legal profession. He's not so much in awe and reverence. He understands that law, the systems are there, the precedents are there, and he's just careful to do his duty and not to offend the court. Another judge is very friendly, a friendship type of relationship, and they respect each other, but there's more of a bonding. But what is most bonding, and what is most powerful, and what is most intimate, is the relationship that the judge has with his little grandson. When he goes home, he takes off his robe, and he's literally on the floor like a horse, and his grandson is riding on his back and slapping the judge in the face. The same judge who in the court, if you just say the wrong thing, he can, attack you for offending the court. But this is the same person who is in different environments, and there are different interactions, different mellows, different rocks, different exchanges, based on the quality of love and based on the position of formality. So the Bhagavad Purana and some of the Vedic teachings, the theology is based on the kind of connection of like a judge with his grandson. And so it takes kind of like a mythological almost kind of mood, because that same judge, it's difficult for someone to think that's the same judge who was in the courtroom with the cloak on, who's seeing people, life imprisonment, fining them, chastising the judge, the other lawyers, threatening, practically being a threat to the jury, so many things. But same person who's now on the floor, and he's just getting rode by his son and literally slapped from time to time in the back and in the face. That relationship is only reserved for that grandson or granddaughter, etc., or small children. That relationship is there because it is of such love, such intimacy, that formality is gone. Formality also has its way of interfering with such the natural flow. Highest love is spontaneous, invigorating, exhilarating, and void of formality. There is a certain limit to the formality when one has to see the judge in such a respectful position who is giving out the orders, etc. But when at home, his most intimate environment, where he is all himself, and not able to receive all the love and affection from those who have an intimate kind of relationship with them. So some of the theology that deals with the idea of a personal God takes on that kind of strangeness for people who are normally seeing the judge only as one who is with the cloak, or the judge in the way that the lawyer sees him, or the judge the way that the jewelers see him. It's not quite so easy. But when we focus on more and more, then yes, the sweetest and the most sublime things are just natural, and they flow without limitations, without restrictions, without formality. But they are about association, and they are about being there for one's beloved and experiencing all that one's beloved is there to serve and to give. So in essence, in summary, we're looking at spontaneity. This last phase we're talking about is spontaneity, personal variegatedness with spontaneity in the spiritual realm, so above, so below. or in the realm where there is eternal romance, eternal exchanges. Just as we were emphasizing how Sarah had a certain relationship with the Godhead, our Muhammad had a certain relationship, Enoch had a certain relationship, and we go on and on to those who have transcended all aspects of the incarceration, and we'll see that they approach the spiritual kingdom with a certain type of mellow, a certain type of rock, based on a specific exchange of love. And then we talked about five types of differences between religions, emphasizing how sometimes these differences for the neophytes will be accelerated to the point that they call sabotaging or attacking one religion versus another. But these differences can often be this part of the expression based on what the commission is of the commissioners, based on how the Lord is arranging to give his love and receive his love according to time, place, and circumstances. Let me go way down to category three types of irreligion, Vidharma, religious principles that obstruct one's following of one's own bona fide practices, Paradharma, religious principles introduced by others, concoctions where bastardization is taking place, Chaladharma, cheating in religion, something that is just going in disguise of religion, but it's something else. Then we share a few points about the conception of God, how according to consciousness and desire, that one will align himself with a certain conception of God. And of course, if one is comfortable with that, then one should pursue it. But one should be genuine in trying to make the connection. Find out what is the goal of that based on the connection, what are the things to do, and take some notice of those who have done such to get a better idea of what you're going to become or experience once one is having such things. Personal communication and contact with God. We kind of focus our theme in the end that everything is really personal. And we want that. We all want to be loved endlessly. We want to be loved unconditionally. We all want to be valued and appreciated. And none of us want to be treated impersonally. And when we're treated impersonally, we feel offended or we feel alienated, etc. And we realize that when we are loving someone is loving us, and we love some objects or whatever, that there is relationship and there is appreciation based on certain specific attributes, certain specific dynamics, connections. So to think that the ultimate is free of all of that, then it means that the ultimate does not have some of the things that's part of the general scheme or part of the reality. The ultimate must have everything that's part of reality and much more sublime and much more eternally. Not that it can have less than that. If the ultimate is impersonal, then how can personalism and variegatedness exist and that be considered the ultimate? The ultimate must include all that there is more eternally and in perfection. And so as we looked at Bible, Quran, Torah, and a few of the mystery schools, you see the emphasis about calling on the names of God, importance of mantra, and affecting consciousness, individual and collective consciousness. We looked at some of the experiences that some of the great messengers have had in their acceleration, and how these experiences were based on a certain specific ras or relationship. And then we ended by talking about how one can view or focus in on the idea of Mother, Father, God, or the Godhead, Supreme Personality of Godhead, in the analogy of like a judge. That the judge, same person, but is evaluated and thought about and interacted with differently, but really according to the connection. Whether it's formal connection, whether it's a business connection, whether it's a family or a love connection. And the more that there is the love on both sides, then the more there is the simplicity and there is the ultimate ongoing flow of natural exchanges. So we end by discussing that higher communication means really understanding who we are, what can be communicated. Higher communication, higher communication means that we connect and that we have genuine communication. Genuine communication can never be there when people are not opening up themselves to revealing what they're really feeling and thinking, when people are not opening up themselves to being able to allow their higher self to connect. Higher communication is very difficult when it is basically in line with the lower modes of material nature, where we're just looking at either how to remove certain obstacles or we're just trying to get more material things and not really trying to process the spiritual, going more into the the interior. So let's remind ourselves, there's really, let me take questions after this half a second. Let's remind ourselves, really, there is one God. And whether we call God to many, many different names, and there's hundreds and thousands, that ultimately there's one supreme source or personality of the Godhead, Mother, Father, God, etc. And that same supreme Godhead is arranging, is sending different teachers according to time, place, and circumstance. And if these teachers themselves, of many different ages and many different systems, if they happen to appear tomorrow in Detroit, one of the things we would notice is that there would be so much love amongst them. And we have to ask ourselves, then why is it that in most cases their followers are not able to have that kind of love toward each other? It's a sign that there's a lot of deviation from these original teachers, and because of that, there is less and less spiritual experiences. People are talking metaphysics and religion. People are talking spirituality, but less and less experiencing. These teachers were never came to put on a performance, but they came to show us what we can do. They came to help us to be able to experience what they are experiencing. And in some cases, they've humbly said, and even more. There is one God, and at least on this planet, there's one nation, or one human species, and of course that's the human species, one nation supposedly under God. We say supposedly because we're always receiving visitors, but we can say that there is ultimately one race on this planet, and that's the human race in this particular dispensation. And we can say that there is one language, although there are many, many languages and many, many dialects, and of course that is the language of the heart. Our hearts know, have very similar things that we're interested in. And it's these universal things that really connect humankind, that allow us to operate with unity and at the same time to honor diversity. And ultimately there's one religion, and that's really the religion of love. So the real issue is how much we're really becoming loving. As we become loving, then all kinds of abilities and talents and all sort of dormant things begin to become available and experienced, because love is what eradicates the lust. And it is lust, egocentricity, individualism, and desire for so much personal greed and sovereignty that blocks and interferes from our ability to be able to have these dynamic personal exchanges. We have opportunities while we're in these physical bodies to gradually to work together to remind each other about the great adventures and the great pleasures that are available for us. We somehow sort of turn our backs on a little bit. And so from time to time, we have books, we have literature, we have rituals, and we have personalities who come into the universe literally just to tap us and to remind us that there is so much waiting that is also yours. Thank you very much. I'm going to just take about 5 or 10 minutes for short questions, and then we have in our restaurant, we have a dinner for you, and there's some books. This is my last day here in the area. I'll be leaving tomorrow morning, and then after a short time, I'll have to go to Malaysia and Russia and some of the other countries. But I hope to be able to come back into the area maybe 2 or 3 times a year. Since my book now has been translated into so many different languages, the last language is Russian and Croatian. And so I'll be going to some of these countries after being away for about 15 years to do some workshops and conferences and seminars, and especially to focus more on leadership training. One of my biggest interests is developing alternative communities where people build their own houses, build their own food, and gradually make their own clothes. Everything I have on, you know, is made by some of the students that I have in different parts of the world. I do these kind of programs in dress different ways. Usually I have, you know, a monk's attire, but these things are all made from shoes to hats, etc. And where we can become more in harmony with nature by using alternative energy sources, if people are able to control their environments a little better, they can be more peaceful, can be more sattvic, and that naturally helps us, you know, also to be more, to be loving. And I'm teaching sometimes some courses on leadership as we're visiting many countries, and also trying to take notice of the fact that the real issue with the world now is a crisis in leadership. And we can somehow be able to have leaders who are more spiritually surcharged, then we'll notice that there will be a tremendous global mind shift. So the masses must be dealt with and approached and helped. At the same time, the leaders are bringing about so much stagnation and blocking a lot of the things that the people can have that can help them in their transition. So if you have a question, raise your hand and we'll try to answer. I think if you can stand, please. And I can see your whole aura, and I can understand better from what's coming out.
I'm just getting out of work. I really am aware of it.
Yes.
But anyway, I was listening to your tape, and I have been reading your book, Spiritual Warrior. I'm really fascinated. I've been reading about the leadership and the great need for them to express more compassion and love. And I'm wondering, are there independent communities in this area in Detroit, or do you have leadership training in this area coming up soon?
Yes. Right in this particular area right now, we don't. I personally involved. See, I'm on a board for about 20 gurus, sages, who oversee major projects around the world. But my specific hands-on project, of course, this is one of them that I'm responsible for as a governing body director. But I have also a community in Pennsylvania where we have about 400 acres of land. And then in West Virginia, where we have 3,000, we're literally building like a spiritual city. And in Africa, we have so many monasteries, etc. And hands on in Switzerland, Italy, France, a few countries. So in these places, we have monasteries, we have cultural centers, restaurants, boutiques, alternative schools, and most important, communities where all of these things can go on at the same time. Here, this community is such that many of the houses on this street, the new street here, what's the name of it? Where the devotees are living? Lenox. Yes, so many of these houses are a part of this project. So we have this facility, and I don't know, maybe up to 20 or more houses or so that priests and people, are living in just in the immediate area that's connected with this particular project. So there's urban projects and there's rural projects also. Yes.
Okay. I would like to know how come seemingly some of these cheating religions, how come that they seem to be successful financially?
Well, just as for instance, the number one business in the world is the drug business. The number two, is defense. And so nothing makes more money, than illicit drugs. We ask, how is it so successful? One, it has clients. And two, the nature of the material energy is pretty dualistic. This is mostly like a reformatory. And so things that are often deviant do seem to excel easier, at least at first. But there's karmic consequence for the deviation. But often, the sinful things do seem to get a leverage. And unfortunately, many people will see that and then turn to a life void of integrity and principle-centeredness, just trying to get, some immediate concerns without understanding that there's karmic responsibility and consequences. This is also why it's important for spiritual people to bond together more, as they're often the minority, so that they're able to remind each other, protect each other, and to have a synergistic and symbiotic effect while one is being so much bombarded by unhealthy things that like-minded people help to encourage each other to remain on the path. Mm-hmm. Yes. Oh, hold the mic up.
Within a framework of time, being human, why does love appear to reduce pain?
Nice question. No one can hurt us more than those who we care for the most. And no one can be as wonderful to us as those who we care for the most. Something that is very powerful, when it is misused, it has the most devastating effect. And when it is access and use properly, then it has the most substantive effect and connection. When we are connecting with someone in a loving manner, we are making ourselves available, we're becoming vulnerable, as we want to receive, but at the same time, the relationship can be exploited. But we were discussing these sort of issues yesterday. Most of our discussion, you know, was on relationship issues, and a lot to do with, you know, romance, with love, with how people can become more whole. And if they're more whole, they're not so much in a needy position, an impoverished position, looking for somebody who's going to make the miracle and make it happen. Because usually, this is what people consider love. Somebody who's very needy, very empty, wanting someone to come into their life who's going to make them feel fulfilled. And then you have two people who have similar type of mentality, who are thinking that the other person is going to make the miracle happen. And so then they just drop their frustrations on each other. Or people who somehow are coming out of a lot of dysfunctional backgrounds, where they really haven't seen really compassionate, loving relationships. It becomes hard to try to access something when the role models, you know, not so dominant. Yes.
Does that also apply to the love of God and love of God's children?
We have free will, just as we are same in quality as God. Rami Mamsa Jivaloke Jivabhutashtana Tanamana Sistani Jani Pakatistani Kasati. Sanskrit Vida explains that we are same in quality, but it's different in quantity. That the soul is eternal, and it's the part of the God, it is the same. But we have free will. And with free will, love always involves the freedom to repose or not. So when someone themselves are loving, they are never doing things that's against the highest well-being of that particular person. Just like we take a little hard mundane example, but take the example of a parent and their child. So the parent, a good parent, is always there wanting to give and extend the love. But sometimes the child refuses to accept, sometimes the child runs away. So for a temporary period, the child is not experiencing the direct connection with that love, but the love is there. But as the child reconnects, then the love that was always there is now experienced. So with our free will, we often turn towards, we turn away, we turn partially away. This is what much of the discussion was. In different ways, we mix the worship, we mix the devotion, we sort of contaminate the situation without allowing the purity to come forth or come through us. Other questions? Yes, in front of you. While we're saying that higher consciousness is the natural, we work so hard in maintaining lower consciousness. we overwork in maintaining lower consciousness.
Are there any world leaders who are hearing your message and implementing anything?
One of my newest books, Leadership for the Age of Higher Consciousness, is out there on the table. We've recently given that to the Prime Minister of England, my last trip of Europe, the President of Mexico. I've personally given it to about 10 presidents of different countries. Just recently, Deepak Chopra received the book. We'll be meeting with him in the future. So, yes, and in our course, we had leaders. We had people from the Department of Defense, Department of Treasury, medical doctors that were taking this course, in some cases to get a higher position or a higher salary, in other cases to assist them in the leadership training that they're doing themselves, national or on an international basis. If you look at the reviews of the book, they've come from one of the best top surgeons in the world, from the United Nations, and the forward is from the Pentagon. So here we're writing a book that is, the subtitle is Administration from a Metaphysical Perspective. So this book was designed after meeting some presidents of countries and realizing that they do not have the time to read many books, and when it comes to spiritual considerations, their first interest is protection. And many, especially in the third world countries where I do a lot of my work, but the main interest is, you know, they're afraid of occultism, juju, sorcery, etc. Their first concern is protection for themselves or their families. Their next concern is how they can have better education, better penal systems, how they can deal with racial conflicts, tribal conflicts, time management. So I wrote the book addressing some of these issues that people and leaders are dealing with on a day-to-day basis. But I'm a spiritualist. I'm not a politician. I'm not a strategician dealing with material energies. I care, in one sense, very little about it. But we wrote the book in such a way that it would address material, metaphysical, and spiritual concerns. And the idea was how the leader could raise his or her consciousness while being able to have technologies that would help the country and would help raise general consciousness by the policies. So yes, we would say that we're getting some feedback. I get sometimes up to 200 emails a day from people all around the world. And many of those are in relationship to the leadership book and especially the Spiritual Warrior 2. Many people are saying that it saved their marriage, it helped them understand more about how to create a balance between material and spiritual, helped them understand their homosexuality, helped them understand this from a metaphysical perspective, a spiritual perspective. My Spiritual Warrior 1, which is uncovering spiritual truths in psychic phenomena. So I deal with all kinds of psychic phenomena, then I take it to another level and show the connection of what this means or what is the spiritual aspect of such. And as we said, they're getting translated, so I would assume that somebody's reading them because they're getting printed and they're going out. Mm-hmm. You have a question? And we'll take two more as it's getting a little late, so we want you to be on work on time and to digest your food. Yes. Your last question? So maybe this is a good point for us to stop before another question comes. We want to thank you all very much for coming out. And do see this as a very important time in planetary history. Just as many of you know that there's an interesting type of alignment that's going on now. Even as we entered into the 21st century, there was not so many external things that happened. There was a lot of prayers and a lot of divine intervention. But actually, a lot of subtle things have infiltrated the planet.